Chapter 22, American Republic versus Global Empire. "I'll be frank," Paula said one day while we were sitting in a coffee shop. "The Indians and all the farmers who live along the river you're damming hate you. Even people in the cities, who aren't directly affected, sympathize with the guerrillas who've been attacking your construction camp. Your government calls these people communists, terrorists, and narcotics traffickers, but the truth is, they're just people with families who live on lands your company is destroying." I had just told her about Manuel Torres. He was an engineer employed by Maine, and one of the men recently attacked by guerrillas at our hydroelectric dam construction site. Manuel was a Colombian citizen who had a job because of a U.S. Department of State rule prohibiting us from sending U.S. citizens to that site. We referred to it as the Colombians are expendable doctrine, and it symbolized an attitude I had grown to hate. My feelings toward such policies were making it increasingly difficult for me to live with myself. According to Manuel, they fired AK-47s into the air and at his feet, I told Paula. He sounded calm when he told me about it, but I know he was almost hysterical. They didn't shoot anyone, just gave them that letter and sent them downriver in their boats. "My God," Paula exclaimed. "The poor man was terrified." Of course he was. I told her that I had asked Manuel whether he thought they were FARC or M19, referring to two of the most infamous Colombian guerrilla groups. "And?" He said neither, but he told me that he believes what they said in that letter. Paula picked up the newspaper I had brought and read the letter aloud. "We who work every day just to survive swear on the blood of our ancestors that we will never allow dams across our rivers. We are simple Indians and mestizos, but we would rather die than stand by as our land is flooded. We warn our Colombian brothers, stop working for the construction companies." She set the paper down. "What did you say to him?" I hesitated, but only for a moment. I had no choice. I had to toe the company line. I asked him if he thought that sounds like a letter a farmer would write. She sat watching me patiently. He just shrugged. Our eyes met. "Oh, Paula, I detest myself for playing this role." "What did you do next?" she pressed. "I slammed my fist on the desk. I intimidated him. I asked him whether farmers with AK-47s made any sense to him. Then I asked if he knew who invented the AK-47. "Did he?" "Yes, but I could hardly hear his answer." "A Russian," he said. Of course, I assured him that he was right, that the inventor had been a communist named Kalashnikov, a highly decorated officer in the Red Army. I brought him around to understand that the people who wrote that note were communists. "Do you believe that?" she asked. Her question stopped me. How could I answer honestly? I recalled Iran and the time Yemen described me as a man caught between two worlds, a man in the middle. In some ways, I wished I had been in that camp when the guerrillas attacked, or that I was one of the guerrillas. An odd feeling crept over me, a sort of jealousy for Yemen and Doc and the Colombian rebels. These were men with convictions. They had chosen real worlds, not a no man's territory somewhere between. "I have a job to do," I said at last. She smiled gently. "I hate it," I continued. I thought about the men whose images had come to me so often over the years. Tom Paine and other Revolutionary War heroes, pirates and frontiersmen. They stood at the edges, not in the middle. They had taken stands and lived with the consequences. "Every day I come to hate my job a little more." She took my hand. "Your job?" Our eyes met and held. I understood the implication. "Myself." She squeezed my hand and nodded slowly. I felt an immediate sense of relief just admitting it. "What will you do, John?" I had no answer. The relief turned into defensiveness. I stammered out the standard justifications, that I was trying to do good, that I was exploring ways to change the system from within, and the old standby, that if I quit, someone even worse would fill my shoes. But I could see from the way she watched me that she was not buying it. Even worse, I knew that I was not buying it either. She had forced me to understand the essential truth. It was not my job, but me that was to blame. "What about you?" I asked at last. "What do you believe?" She gave a little sigh and released my hand, asking, "You trying to change the subject?" I nodded. "Okay," she agreed, "under one condition, that we'll return to it another day." She picked up a spoon and appeared to examine it. "I know that some of the gorillas have trained in Russia and China." She lowered the spoon into her café con leche, stirred, and then slowly licked the spoon. "What else can they do? They need to learn about modern weapons and how to fight the soldiers who've gone through your schools. Sometimes they sell cocaine in order to raise money for supplies. How else can they buy guns? They're up against terrible odds. Your World Bank doesn't help them defend themselves. In fact, it forces them into this position." She took a sip of coffee. "I believe their cause is just. The electricity will help only a few, the wealthiest Colombians, and thousands will die because the fish and water are poisoned after you build that dam of yours." Hearing her speak so compassionately about the people who opposed us, me, caused my flesh to crawl. I found myself clawing at my forearms. "How do you know so much about the gorillas?" Even as I asked it, I had a sinking feeling, a premonition that I did not want to know the answer. "I went to school with some of them," she said. She hesitated, pushed her cup away. "My brother joined the movement." There it was. I felt absolutely deflated. I thought I knew all about her. But this, I had the fleeting image of a man coming home to find his wife in bed with another man. "How come you never told me?" "Seemed irrelevant. Why would I? It isn't something I brag about." She paused. "I haven't seen him for 2 years. He has to be very careful." "How do you know he's alive?"
"I don't, except recently the government put him on a wanted list. That's a good sign."
I was fighting the urge to be judgmental or defensive. I hoped she could not discern my jealousy.
"How did he become one of them?" I asked.
Fortunately, she kept her eyes on the coffee cup.
"Demonstrating outside the offices of an oil company, Occidental, I think. He was protesting drilling on indigenous lands, in the forests of a tribe facing extinction, him and a couple dozen of his friends. They were attacked by the army, beaten and thrown into prison, for doing nothing illegal, mind you, just standing outside that building, waving placards and singing."
She glanced out a nearby window.
"They kept him in jail for nearly 6 months. He never did tell us what happened there, but when he came out, he was a different person."
It was the first of many similar conversations with Paula. And I now know that these discussions set the stage for what was to follow. My soul was torn apart, yet I was still ruled by my wallet and by those other weaknesses the NSA had identified when they profiled me a decade earlier in 1968. By forcing me to see this and to confront the deeper feelings behind my fascination with pirates and other rebels, Paula helped me along the trail toward salvation. Beyond my own personal dilemmas, my times in Colombia also helped me comprehend the distinction between the old American Republic and the new global empire. The Republic offered hope to the world. Its foundation was moral and philosophical, rather than materialistic. It was based on concepts of equality and justice for all. But it also could be pragmatic. Not merely a utopian dream, but also a living, breathing, magnanimous entity. It could open its arms to shelter the downtrodden,
It was an inspiration, and at the same time, a force to reckon with. If needed, it could swing into action, as it had during World War II, to defend the principles for which it stood. The very institutions, the big corporations, banks, and government bureaucracies, that threatened the Republic, could be used instead to institute fundamental changes in the world. Such institutions possess the communications networks and transportation systems necessary to end disease, starvation, and even wars, if only they could be convinced to take that course. The global empire, on the other hand, is the Republic's nemesis. It is self-centered, self-serving, greedy, and materialistic, a system based on mercantilism. Like empires before, its arms open only to accumulate resources, to grab everything in sight and stuff its insatiable maw. It will use whatever means it deems necessary to help its rulers gain more power and riches. Of course, in learning to understand this distinction, I also developed a clearer sense of my own role. Claudine had warned me. She had honestly outlined what would be expected of me if I accepted the job Maine offered. Yet it took the experience of working in countries like Indonesia, Panama, Iran, and Colombia in order for me to understand the deeper implications. And it took the patience, love, and personal stories of a woman like Paula. I was loyal to the American Republic, but what we were perpetrating through this new, highly subtle form of imperialism was the financial equivalent of what we had attempted to accomplish militarily in Vietnam. If Southeast Asia had taught us that armies have limitations, the economists had responded by devising a better plan, and the foreign aid agencies and the private contractors who served them, or, more appropriately, were served by them, had become proficient at executing that plan. In countries on every continent, I saw how men and women working for U.S. corporations, though not officially part of the EHM network, participated in something far more pernicious than anything envisioned in conspiracy theories. Like many of Maine's engineers, these workers were blind to the consequences of their actions, convinced that the sweatshops and factories that made shoes and automotive parts for their companies were helping the poor climb out of poverty, instead of simply burying them deeper in a type of slavery reminiscent of medieval manors and southern plantations. Like those earlier manifestations of exploitation, modern serfs or slaves were socialized into believing they were better off than the unfortunate souls who lived on the margins, in the dark hollows of Europe, in the jungles of Africa, or in the wilds of the American frontier. The struggle over whether I should continue at Maine or should quit had become an open battlefield. There was no doubt that my conscience wanted out, but that other side, what I like to think of as my business school persona, was not so sure. My own empire kept expanding. I added employees, countries, and shares of stock to my various portfolios and to my ego. In addition to the seduction of the money and lifestyle and the adrenaline high of power, I often recalled Claudine warning me that once I was in, I could never get out. Of course, Paula sneered at this. What would she know? I pointed out that Claudine had been right about a great many things. That was a long time ago. Lives change. Anyway, what difference does it make? You're not happy with yourself. What can Claudine or anyone else do to make things worse than that? It was a refrain Paula often came back to, and I eventually agreed. I admitted to her and to myself that all the money, adventure, and glamour no longer justified the turmoil, guilt, and stress. As a Maine partner, I was becoming wealthy, and I knew that if I stayed longer, I would be permanently trapped. One day, while we were strolling along the beach near the old Spanish fort at Cartagena, a place that had endured countless pirate attacks, Paula hit upon an approach that had not occurred to me. "What if you never say anything about the things you know?" she asked. You mean, just keep quiet? Exactly. Don't give them an excuse to come after you. In fact, give them every reason to leave you alone, to not muddy the water. It made a great deal of sense. I wondered why it never occurred to me before. I would not write books or do anything else to expose the truth as I had come to see it. I would not be a crusader. Instead, I would just be a person, concentrate on enjoying life, travel for pleasure, perhaps even start a family with someone like Paula. I had had enough. I simply wanted out. "Everything Claudine taught you is a deception," Paula added. "Your life's a lie." She smiled condescendingly. "Have you looked at your own resume recently?" I admitted that I had not. "Do," she advised. "I read the Spanish version the other day. If it's anything like the English one, I think you'll find it very interesting."